We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have once again here on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service to do our monthly show on home maintenance. If you have questions about your house, some problem, you need to get a solution, call in and you can talk with Scott and he'll give you the benefit of his experience. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Morning, David. Once again, glad to be here.
We have some callers ready to go. We'll just get right on it and start with line number one right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Two questions. First is regarding furnace fan. Second is on mold on site. So on the furnace fan, can you give me an idea or your recommendation for the most energy-efficient use of the furnace fan? Leave the fan in the on position or the auto position? I've been told that it takes more energy to start the fan if it's in auto position as opposed to running continuously, and it's just counterintuitive, and so I just wanted to get your opinion.
All right. Well, I don't recommend running the fan in the on position during the air conditioning season.
Okay.
The reason being the air conditioner condenser cycles on and off. And if you leave the fan running while the compressor is cycled off, the A-coil is not cold, so therefore you end up re-evaporating the moisture that collected on it. So you end up pushing the moisture back into the house.
I see.
When the coil is running and it's cold and it's condensing moisture on it and it drips down and goes into the condensate drain. But as soon as that compressor shuts off, the coil starts warming up and so the water starts re-evaporating back into the house. So while you can still cool the house and it will actually help circulate the air, so if you've got a two-story house, it tends to feel a little bit more even from top to bottom. But the problem is it doesn't pull the humidity out of the house, which around here that's probably half its job.
I see. Now we're using heat pumps. Is that any different, or is that still the same?
Still the same principle.
Okay. Okay. Good. Okay. So, and the next question is on the north side. Of course, we have problems with moss, mold, mildew, whatever you want to call it, on our vinyl siding. And I wondered if you had a recommended solution to remove it, and also if there's any way to prevent its growth.
Okay. The moss, mildew, green stuff. It's not actually growing on the vinyl. It's growing on the dirt on the vinyl. Vinyl is not a food. Therefore, the plant life cannot grow on it. So it's only growing on the dirt. So it should be fairly easy to wash off. Sometimes it washes off a little bit easier if you spray a Clorox and water mix or a bleach and water mix on it to kind of kill it off first, and then you can wash it down. I don't recommend the use of a high-pressure sprayer. Vinyl siding is not necessarily watertight. It's waterproof. Water doesn't affect the vinyl, but moisture can get behind the vinyl at the joints. The manufacturer actually has weep holes at the bottom of the siding.
Right.
So something more on the lines of a brush and a garden hose. I have in the past recommended one of these large extended handle brushes that they use for doing washing motorhomes and stuff, usually available at the auto parts stores, so you can get a little bit more of an extended reach for the higher places. But, basically soap and water.
Okay. Would you add any bleach or anything like that to the water?
I wouldn't while washing. It would be something that if the moss is stubborn, you might want to mix it up in a sprayer and spray it a day or two before you want to wash it, and that way the bleach will kill off the mold or the mildew or the algae or whatever it is, and the roots will be softer, and so things will wash off a little bit easier. But, no, you shouldn't need to add it while washing.
Ah, very good. Okay, thanks, Scott.
All right, thank you. We'll go on here, and we have a couple of other people next to someone on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Morning.
I've about this work on moss and mildew. I've used diluted bleach with some success where I can scrub it, such as concrete or large stone. But how do I use it for moss and mildew on stones too small and loose to scrub?
If you're using it on small stones, probably Again, the bleach solution will help kill off the plant growth, and then you'd use a water sprayer, probably a pressure washer, although if you're looking at small rocks, that just tends to move them. Boy, I haven't got a good solution for that one. That'd be, what, the gravel around the outside of the house or something?
It's just very small stone, like an inch across. And, of course, I can't scrub it, and the bleach without scrubbing doesn't seem to have any effect.
Well, it should kill off the plant growth so that at least it dies and washes off on its own. But, with small rocks, I haven't got a good way of, short of a rock tumbler, which, of course, is going to be kind of hard to do for all the rocks in the front yard.
Yeah, I don't
know that I've got a good solution for that. There's probably some other, you might try spraying them, depending on where they're at, you could probably spray them with like a Roundup or some type of herbicide that we use for controlling weeds in the yard, because the moss is a weed. It is a growth. So something like that may kill it off and help prevent it from growing back. And unfortunately, I think it's just going to take a little bit of time and some rain to wash it down.
Okay. Other question. What implements are helpful and harmless for cleaning debris from the roof? Certainly not a rake or a shovel, but what about a stiff broom or a blower?
A leaf blower will work if you're going to get up on top of the roof. A garden hose doesn't do bad. As long as you start from the top and wash down, it'll wash most things down. Brooms, anytime you're rubbing anything over the top of the shingles, yes, it is going to be slightly abrasive. You're always going to lose a little bit of mineral granules off of the shingle tabs. That's just part of the life cycle on the tabs. Now, of course, the more you brush it or the more you move stuff around, the faster it'll wear. So it's not something you want to do on a regular basis. But depending on what you've got up there, if you've got some just general leaves and they're relatively dry, then something like a leaf blower would work. If it's something, pine needles don't tend to move around as well with a leaf blower, so you might be able to take a garden hose and kind of and a sprayer nozzle. Again, not a high pressure because we don't want to do any damage to the shingles, but just kind of wash things down.
I take it that your best time on the roof is when it's not extremely hot or cold.
Exactly. That is correct. The shingles, if they're very hot, the granules will be loosened while you walk on them. And if they're very cold, you take a chance of breaking the shingles or breaking the bond of the shingle tab to the shingle below it.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Very good questions. Very good. Thank you for calling.
Up to another caller here, line number two. Hello.
A house has been vacant for a year, and I noticed recently the garage, when I open it, it smells like moisture, mildew, mold. There's some furniture stored in the garage that is starting to mold, and I was wondering why and what I can do about that.
Has the air conditioner been turned on or off?
This is the garage. The house is fine. I've got the air conditioner on in the house, but this is the garage I'm speaking of.
Okay. You probably want to put a dehumidifier out there. What's going to happen is, since you're not moving any air through there, the concrete slab is going to try and stay between 55 and 60 degrees just from temperature from the earth. And when we have these really hot, humid days like we're having currently, that slab is cold enough that we can actually get condensation on the slab. So we end up with this little microscopic film of moisture on the concrete. And if we're not opening the door and not getting any air moved through there, you will end up with a very high humidity level in the garage. So probably the easiest thing is to put in a dehumidifier out in the garage. If you're going to store things out there, definitely put in a dehumidifier and just let it run. You'll have to run the hose from it out the bottom of the garage door or something so that it drains the water away if there's no floor drain. But, the garage, because of the natural cooling effect that we get from the earth, you will end up with that moisture condensation in there, and you got to get some airflow moving or get that humidity out.
Okay, so just will I need to leave the dehumidifier in there the rest of the summer?
I would. You recommend that, yes.
Okay. Then someone said, this is just to clarify, someone has those plastic vent things in their house, and they're heading it towards the ceiling. That doesn't seem right that you would make the cold air go up. You know what I mean?
Okay, yes, I know. You're talking about the deflectors or diffusers that would go on your registers for your air conditioning and heating system.
Yes. Are you supposed to turn those so the air goes up?
Actually, the cooling season, the best thing for the air is to go up because the cold air naturally is heavier than the warm air, and so it tends to want to stay at the floor. So you do get a better circulation if it moves the upwards. Now, are you referring to on the first floor? I'm assuming that the one-story or two-story house?
It's a one-story, and they have them so that, the vents at the close to the floor, and they had these plastic things making the air go up, and so you're it seems rather hot as you're sitting near them because all the cool air is going up.
Well, but the cooler air is going to come back down. It's going to actually prevent a little bit of stratification. When you put cold air in at the floor, it does tend to stay at the floor. So your ceiling ends up being a few degrees warmer than what your floor area is. And by pointing the registers up, they are trying to circulate a little bit more. So it should actually work better. The other thing to do would be to turn on, of course, a ceiling fan or a little box fan to keep the air from circulating and reducing that stratification. We put the heat
They have a ceiling fan, but they also had these things turned up. So should they do both? Should they have these things so the air is going up as well as the ceiling fan?
With the cooling system, as much air movement as you're going to get, the more comfortable you're going to feel because the air moving over the top of you is going to give you a cool sensation or a perception of being cooler in the room, whether the temperature is actually up or not. But you're going to be losing moisture from your body, so you're going to be cooler. So, yeah, a little bit of air movement is probably quite helpful. The reason they put the heat ducts in the floor is because in the heating season, that's the optimum place to put it. And we have more heating days around central Illinois than we do cooling days. So to make the system more efficient more often, they put the vents in the floor. Ideally, if we wanted the air conditioning to be very efficient, we'd put the registers actually in the ceiling in the middle of the room and let the cold air fall down.
One more question about the garage. The furniture that's in there is starting to mold. Do you just wash that off with soap and water?
Yeah, you're going to have to get a good furniture cleaner, carpet-type cleaner or upholstery cleaner. And my guess
is
you're probably...
It's not upholstery. It's wood.
Okay. Then you should be able to just wash it down with one of the, Old English or a couple of the different soaps designed for the hardwood.
Should I take it outside and let the moisture come out of it, or will this dehumidifier pull it out of the furniture as well?
The dehumidifier will pull it out of the furniture as well because it'll pull the moisture from everywhere.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, certainly.
Thank you. And let's go back here to our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say thank you both for doing this show. I greatly appreciate WILL-AM. What I have is a question. I have a... 6-room house, run the air conditioner during the summer to keep it between 75 and 77. What would be the estimated humidity level that I could expect?
It's going to be kind of dependent on how tight the house is.
Okay.
The moisture that we're getting into the house is actually the humidity from outdoors because, again, today when we're 90 degrees out and we're 85% humidity, I believe the weather forecast said it was going to be wet today. Whether it rains or not, it's just going to be really wet and humid. So when that moisture comes into the house, then we have to pull it back out. Now, the tighter the house is, the less air movement into it, then the easier it is to pull the moisture level or the humidity level down. In older houses, and just for reference, like a farmhouse, we may have 24 or 30 air exchanges in a 24-hour period. All the air just kind of moves through the house on a regular basis. They dry out like crazy in the wintertime, and they stay humid as heck in the summertime. On new construction houses where we may have 4 or 5 air exchanges, or a very high-efficiency house where we could have as little as 3 air exchanges, now the air stays in the house so that the moisture doesn't come through the house as quickly. So once we pull it down, it stays down longer. So if you've got a humidity level that you feel is high, even with the air conditioner on, then maybe we need to start looking into sealing around some windows, making sure that we've got good insulation, things like that. Ideally, this time of year, if you can keep it around the 50 to 55% range, you're going to be pretty dry.
Okay. That is the figure that I needed to know.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty dry. You'd be hard-pressed to get it under 50% with the moisture levels that we've got outdoors right now.
Okay. Thank you.
right.
Conversely, if you end up with, say, 65 or 70%, it may be a little too wet in the house. So you need to make sure that you find out where that moisture is coming from.
Okay. And if you really want to know, you can, for not very much money, you can buy a little thing that you can put, move it around, whatever room to room, basement, attic, whatever, that will tell you what the humidity
is.
Yeah.
The little battery-operated hygrometers are anywhere from, I think I've seen them as low as $8 or $9 on up to about $29. Yeah. Or you can get the full weather stations. It'll tell you the one hygrometer readings from outside and inside, and so you get an idea of how relatively dry it is in the house compared to outdoors.
Yeah. All right. Scott Spies is our guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is with us once a month on a Monday to talk about home maintenance. And if you have a question, call us, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next, we have someone here, line one. Hello.
Hello, yes. Mm-hmm. We live in a ranch, and I have a question about vent fans in bathrooms. In both our full and half bath, the conduit from the vent fans just passes through the insulation and vents the air under the roof sheeting. And in the winter, in the half bath, of course, you get condensation in that line, and you can get rained on in the freeze-thaw cycles in the half bath. So this, obviously that's not the proper way to vent the bathroom fans, I guess, and I'd like to hear how they should be vented.
Well, the bathroom vent fan is supposed to have a flapper valve on it. The box for the fan actually has a little tin lid on it, so when the fan is on, it opens. And when it turns off, it's supposed to close. My guess is what's happening is it's not closing, and so we're getting the warm, humid air in the house up into the ductwork all the time. And, of course, the duct being in the attic is cold enough to get the condensation in there, so you do end up with some water collecting. A couple of different things that you can do. First of all, burying the duct in the insulation instead of running it across the top of the insulation so that it doesn't get as cold, so we don't get the condensation. Although you still end up with some cold air coming in the output where it comes out to the soffit area.
Okay.
I've also seen people take and basically put a trap in it, run the duct up towards the top of the trusses and then back down and put a big loop in it. And
sort of like a trap then.
Yeah, like a trap. And what that'll do is the warm air will go to the top and kind of stay there, and so the cold air won't want to back down through it. But again, you can still get a little bit of condensation through there, unless it's an insulated duct. My guess is if you're getting a lot of rain through that, either you're not running the fan long enough after the shower, or the humidity level in the house may be a bit, little on the high side.
Yeah.
So again, keeping the house dry will help reduce that. And what I like is to put a fan for the bathroom on a timer. That way, when you take your shower, you can turn the timer to, say, 30 minutes. You take your shower and you leave, and it runs for a few minutes after you get done. And that way, we make sure we clear that line and help clear the moisture out of the bathroom. And as long as the air is moving through the duct, we shouldn't be getting the condensation because it should have enough air moving through it to keep the moisture suspended in the air or vapored and the vapor pushing to the outside.
Okay, great. Thanks for the suggestions.
All right, thank you for the call. I guess I you know, this is something we've talked about before. I'm sure we've had questions about this before, and I just wonder, on general principles, whether it's, if you could, wouldn't you rather vent to the outside than have the vent going into the attic?
Well, that's correct. If you've, depending kind of on the amount of ventilation in the attic, if you've got a very good ventilation in the attic, as long as the duct is not blowing directly against something where we can get condensation, you're probably all right. Yes, it would be more ideal to get it to the outside, and I believe our caller had it vented out to the soffit area, so it was actually blowing in past the insulation out into the soffit, and letting it, the soffit area is usually pretty well ventilated. That's where the primary ventilation for the house is. But yeah, if either to a gable vent or to a roof vent, ideally it should be getting to the outside.
Yeah. All right. To line number two next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Wow, no line. How about that? I know I need to consult someone who I can talk to and show this to him, but I thought I'd try and get some background to the whole project of bracing a stud wall in a story and a half construction where somebody just took an exterior wall to extend the porch, get rid of the porch, basically. And I don't see any deflection in the joist rafters in this ceiling, but there's apparently enough play in the whole thing that it always pulls the patches and the shingles apart. So there's been a persistence. So basically, I'm pretty sure it needs to be braced. But I'm wondering whether you can say something generally about in a really old house, 100 years old, to with foundation settling problems. I've just bought a floor jack to put underneath the floor to put the post in, and then I've got a laminar beam on Arter. I'm going to carriage bolt the remainder of the studs to the laminar beam, and I just I know you have to see it to really comment, but I thought I'd ask you to just to go through maybe some of the considerations.
Well, I'm trying to picture what it is you're referring to. I'm not sure that I've got the gist of what the direction
maybe
we're going.
Yeah, that's a futile call, and I really just go to somebody. But I thought if I had some considerations before.
Well, I can try and help you. Is this you say that there's a porch has been removed?
Right. Many. I don't even know how many years ago. There's an old foundation. There's a new foundation, and they just basically. I've only just now pulled down the ceiling to see what I expected. I thought maybe they might have tried to do some bracing, but apparently they just cut the stud wall. And it's a wall, it's a story and a half construction, so there's a roof line below it, but then the stud wall actually is a supporting wall for one of the rooms in the upstairs. So it's obvious, it's just sort of, everything's cantilevered, everything's just hanging. And I just, like I say, I can't see, and I've had a carpenter come and look at it, and she can't see any deflection in the beams, and a friend of mine as well. So, but there's enough. This is my my thought is that the persistent recurring leaks are due to the fact that there's too much play in the roof. It's just not solid enough to stand any kind of wind load or trucks going by and vibrations, and it just keeps pulling any patches apart. So.
Well, generally, a roof does have some flexibility and some movement. You put down a tar paper, and you put the shingles on top of the tar paper, and the adhesive that holds the shingles tabs down is supposed to dry to kind of a tarry type consistency, not be real hard, so it can allow for some slow movement. If you get some sudden movement or excessive movement, we can either tear shingles or we can pull the bond apart.
Well, often it's a nail. It seems to be a nail that pulls the...
Nails going up, coming up on, out of the shingles?
No.
Okay.
No, I just think I've traced it to, I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. It's a mystery sometimes where the leak
is. Well, it sounds like something that would be interesting to come out and take a look at. Mm-hmm. Anytime you've got something cantilevered where you've got a support wall and a floor joist going out unsupported for any number of feet, the rule of thumb is to have the cantilever run back towards the framing twice the extension. So basically, instead of making a teeter-totter, if you've got a 3-foot or 4-foot extension, we need to go back 6 or 8 feet back underneath the house floor to actually provide proper support.
Only a cantilever in the sense that they didn't support the stud wall is what I'm saying. It wasn't intentional. It was just, I think it was a chop job by a realtor who wanted to make 3 units out of the place or something. Real quick, and
is the stud wall actually load bearing? You say for the room upstairs?
There's some question because the joists are parallel to that, and I could say they aren't showing any deflection. So I'm curious as to whether how load bearing it is. But I think it's load bearing, and I mean all walls are somewhat load bearing. When you take a window out, you're supposed to put a header on it, right? So.
There's always some weight on there, but of course, end walls don't have as much as what a front or back wall that
has. This is a 16-foot span, and they didn't do anything to brace. They just cut the studs out and covered the,
Unfortunately, I think my official radio response is going to be that we need to have a structural engineer or licensed architect take a look at it to help figure that out.
Yeah, I knew that was probably. I know I'm going to do that. I just thought there might be something to.
That being said, if it's local or somewhere nearby and you'd like me to come out and take a look at it, it's something you've got me intrigued to the point where I'd be more than happy to take a quick gander if you needed somebody.
Well, okay, I'll ask you about that off. Basically, the kind of questions I was asking, was thinking about in terms of is I plan on carriage bolting the laminar beam to the studs, and I'd probably just do it right where it is, and with the idea that, I'm not going to try and, there's one place where you can see that there's actually a 3/4 to 1/2 inch drop between you have to see it to believe it, but so there's definitely been some
Well, attaching it to the laminated beam, lag bolts, or depending on how they attach metal straps, joist hangers, things like that, will help make sure that we've got a good connection. The laminated beam will give you will help spread your load out to a larger area, so that whatever it is, if we've got some deflection, you say we don't have deflection, but we've got movement, which is what's got me confused.
Right.
That's something we'd have to take a look at.
It's an overbuilt house. It's got lots of wood that they probably didn't need to use as far as the size of the joist rafters. But
back when they built the houses quite some time ago, the lumber was a little bit more available and larger dimensions. So they quite often.
Okay. Well, thanks.
Thank you for calling in.
Okay. We're about midway through this part of Focus. Our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here on the program once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. And if you've got a problem, call in and tell us about it, and he'll see what he can do. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next is the toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We acquired a house that has a sump discharge that actually discharges out onto the surface, and we're curious about what viable alternatives are there for discharging. Essentially, it's the sump water, and it's also the washing machine discharge. And I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, if the laundry is going to it, it's supposed to go to the sanitary sewer. However, if groundwater is getting to it, it is not supposed to go to the sanitary sewer. So it is not correct or proper to run the laundry into the sump pump. That being said, it kind of depends on the municipality. Most of the time, what I have found in our areas is that they do not want you connecting a sump pump system direct to either a sewer drain for a sanitary or for a storm sewer. Now, they do have some areas where they have sized storm sewers where you can put a sump pump direct to it. Basically, because a sump pump is a forced line or a pumped line, two or three sump pump lines will fill what normally a gravity drain system could handle for, say, 7 or 8 houses, because they will move a lot more water. So they really prefer that your sump pump does go to the surface, and that way it gravity drains into the storm sewer. You don't want it to drain into the sanitary sewer, because then every time it rains, the sanitary system kind of gets flooded out to sea because everybody's sump pump tends to go off. Basically, what we need here is an ejection pump. They do make some freestanding ejection pumps that would collect the laundry and run it to the sanitary drain, and then your sump pump would then go out to a surface drain, or if the municipality in that area allows it, then we could go to a storm drain. If it's keeping an area really wet, we got to look at two things. One, where is the water coming from? Why is my sump pump running that often? Some grading and downspouts around the outside of the house may greatly reduce the amount of water that actually ends up in the sump, so therefore we don't have to worry about how much water comes out of the end of the sump pump. If it's an area where we can't do that, you may need to dig a gravel pit and have the sump pump come into the gravel pit. And on times of light rains, it can soak down through the gravel. In periods of heavy rain, it can actually build up and flow out the top of the gravel. I do know that in some areas they allow you connect to the storm sewer, and that would be the other alternative. However, you're not going to be able to run that laundry system into the storm sewer. So it may take two systems to get everything out. So appreciate the call on that. And it is something that I do find on a regular basis where that laundry does run to the sump pump. And I have found in several places, including some of the farm tractor supply type stores where they have a sewage ejection bucket, basically a 5-gallon bucket with a pump in it that can be used to lift your laundry up to the sewer level. So I think that'll take care of him.
Hope that helps. Again, our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send along your questions by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And again, we'll go to another caller here on our toll-free line once again, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Going back to the prior call of the venting of the bath fan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to figure out, I need a bath fan up on my second level. Do I have to go out through the roof to vent that, or can I vent that out underneath an eave? And do they make a, some kind of flap or a discharge that would go outside for that?
Yes, they do make an end for the ducts. There's several different types. So if you go out through an eave, you'll need one that has a spring loaded so that the flap will stay closed, because generally speaking, it'll be facing down. But it takes very light pressure for it to open. You could also run it to a gable end instead of running out to an eave. You find one of the flat. Most houses have one or two gables on them. Not all of them. Basically, if you can get it out into that soffit area, there's good ventilation out in that soffit area, so it can either ventilate through there, or you put the cover on it, which will ventilate it out through the soffit area. But you're going to want to try and keep the duct under the insulation if you can, or put some more insulation over the top of it, because laying relatively flat and getting cold, it can tend to collect a little bit of moisture.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We've got plenty of time. You want to call in and talk with Scott, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I had been thinking here, going back to the question somebody was asking about what's safe to do if you want to try to clean off your roof.
Mm-hmm.
And it started me thinking that that as part of natural wear of the roof, as you say, some of those little granules that are in the asphalt shingles are going to come out. And I'm thinking about how, you know, sometimes after a heavy rain, if you walk around your house and you look at your downspouts and the place where the water comes out, you're going to see there are some of those little granules. Now I'm thinking, well, okay, now how do you know, is that, you know, that is sort of normal wear and some of that is going to wear off? How do you know, is this a problem? Is this not a problem?
Well, actually, when the shingles are brand new is when you'll find most of the granules at the bottom of the gutters, because when they're new, basically what happens with an asphalt shingle, they have either a fiberglass or an organic mat. It's impregnated with an asphalt-type material, and then they spray this mineral granule over the top of it, which is our UV protectant or sunlight protectant to keep the asphalt from drying out. Of course, when it's brand new, we've got a bunch of loose particles on it. So at first, when you put the roof on, it's very common to find a lot of granules at the bottom. As it wears, yes, granules will fall off, and the harder the rain or the more abusive, you know, a little light hail or something like that will knock granules off. What I do when trying to evaluate the age of a roof is I get up on the roof, look relatively closely at the shingles. If I can see any exposed mat or asphalt, mm-hmm. It's usually an indication that we've only got a couple years left on the shingle, because in those areas, the sunlight can actually get to the asphalt and start to deteriorate it. And I've actually seen them be able to eat through within a year. Now, a shingle is a full double coverage. What you see of the shingle is only half the shingle. The one that goes underneath it goes at least as far as what that tab is. So basically, we've got a 9-inch wide shingle with a 4-inch or 4.5-inch exposure. So even if it does wear through the top one, we should still be protected by the one underneath it. So it doesn't necessarily mean a leak immediately, but it does mean that the shingles are wearing out. And you want to avoid walking on the roof, particularly hot weather. We want to avoid trees rubbing on the roof. We want to avoid the high-pressure washers on a roof.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like to see many of my clients on a roof. Unless you're really comfortable up there and really feel confident about a roof, stay off of it.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Well, we have some other callers here, and we'll take them in the order they came in. I think that means we'll go first to line one right here. Hello.
Very good.
Yes. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I have a question about possibly mold. My little house in Potomac has, it's a ranch-style home, and it would be like a straight little ranch, but then there's this room, which is the master bedroom that comes forward. And so there's a couple of what you call valleys. And apparently one or more of those got a lot of debris in them from a tree that was overhanging. It's gone now. And so there was some water damage showing up inside the house on the drywall and the ceiling. So I thought, well, I'll go up in the attic. And so I got up there and I tried to get over to that area, but the builder had put a solid partition so that I can't get through. over that one room, which is about 15 by 20 feet of a room. And I'm wondering, should I just saw through that particle board partition and go in there? And what if it's all moldy in there? What do I just burn the place down and start over?
Well, we're going to hope that it doesn't come to that. It is relatively common when we have a projection, a roof coming out, that the builder does not cut through the sheathing from one section to the other. Hopefully, at some point in time, they were able to get up there to insulate. And, yes, you can cut the sheathing in between a couple of joists. Now, of course, you want to make sure you do it in an area where it's under the protection of the roof from the other side. So usually you start with a small hole down low and see. Then once you can stick your head through there and see where you're cutting, then you can cut a larger section out of it.
Okay.
But that plywood should not be supporting anything. I'm assuming it's on a slope. Basically, the roof sheathing slopes out, and then they built the roof for the master. It kind of extended out from on top of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you should be able to get to access that. Start with a hole towards the bottom. Look in
okay.
there, make sure it's clear. I wouldn't be going in there expecting a lot of mold and mildew. The valleys usually, when they start to leak, the water will run down, and you'll end up with more moisture in the insulation than you will in the sheathing and such. But it'll usually dry out pretty quick because drywall doesn't take a lot of water before it starts showing stains or starts deteriorating.
Uh-huh.
So my guess is you caught it before we had a chance to get a lot of mold and mildew in there.
Oh, okay. All right. But if there is.
If there is, then you'll have to pull the affected insulation out and either paint or wash the affected areas. Sometimes just kind of cleaning things out and going over it with one of these airless spray guns and painting it and encapsulating any of the mold and mildew spores inside the paint will quite often solve the problem, and then you can put your insulation back in.
Okay. I'll give that a try. By the way, if you talk about downspouts and a lot of granules and things, if you somehow affix a magnet, a small magnet down there at the bottom, and wait for a few months, and then you check the magnet, you'll find things attached to it because there's meteorites falling out of the sky.
Yeah, our acid rain and all sorts of things, yeah. And occasionally you'll get the roof nail, too. So.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
We had some weather information I want to pass on to you, then we'll get back to calls and questions. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of central Illinois that will be in effect until 5 o'clock this afternoon. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles an hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. And in the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes these Illinois counties: DeWitt, Macon, Moultrie, and Piatt. So do remember, a severe thunderstorm watch means conditions are favorable for severe storms in and close to the watch area. Keep an eye on the sky for threatening weather conditions. Stay tuned to AM 580, FM 90.9 with latest weather information and possible warnings. Severe thunderstorms can and occasionally do produce tornadoes. So again, this is a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect for these counties in our severe weather coverage area: DeWitt, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, until 5 o'clock this afternoon. We get more information on the weather, we'll pass it on just as soon as we get it. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. It's always on a Monday. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And was it something you wanted to
I was just
going to
say, with the possibility of 2-inch hail, all bets are off on
how
well the
yeah.
roof is going to survive and how many mineral granules we're going to get at the
that's
bottom of that.
That's not going to stand up to big hail. Let's go to line 2 for a caller right here. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm considering an attic fan, probably, or one with a solar panel. So in terms of, or have you known the history of these things or how well they work or they don't work?
Well, it's going to depend on the style of attic. Generally speaking, an attic fan may or may not work well enough to justify its the energy use. If you have a properly ventilated attic area, the fan is not going to help a lot.
Mm-hmm.
by properly ventilated. What I'm looking for is a vent towards the top of the roof and some type of air inlet or vent towards the bottom of the roof. The most common one we find is the soffits have some perforations in it or vents in them, and then we put either a ridge vent at the very top of the roof or we put some button vents on the back of it, and the button vents allow the air out. And what happens is the sun hits the roof area, heats up the attic, hot air rises, the cool air comes in from the bottom. If we've got this natural convection, there's really no good reason to put a fan system in it. The reason I'm not real keen on the fan systems is that they only work to pull out a little bit of heat. They do not work in the wintertime, which, in my opinion, is when we need most of our attic ventilation. If we have excess moisture up there, we can get condensation in the attic pretty quick. So any humidity in the house tends to collect on a cold surface. The roof sheathing being above the insulation is the coldest spot, so high humidity in the house will create moisture problems in the attic. So if you're putting in a powered vent fan to supplement a inadequate vent system, it works great in the summertime, but it's not giving you the ventilation you need in the wintertime, and we can actually delaminate sheathing or create mold and mildew problems in an attic. So kind of overview, I want to see a good ventilation system that runs pretty much year-round. If you've got 8 to 10 inches of insulation already up in your attic, the heat that's in the attic really isn't coming down and affecting the house much, because heat does radiate more upward than it does downward. So it's not going to warm the ceilings a lot, so it doesn't necessarily help your cooling load with the with an attic fan.
Okay. The next question is in terms of, I was going to ask it, but then you talked about roofs. There's only one level on at this point, so there's no problem with putting another level on, right, in terms of roofing?
If there's one layer of shingles, then you, with a proper installation, you can put another layer on. We do like to see the back of the new shingles to line up with the bottom of the tabs on the old shingles rather than overlay them. If you overlap them, in other words, the very first row, what we'll call the starter row, which is right there next to the gutters, when you put a second layer on, that starter row is going to be shortened more than what the rest of the shingles are. Normally, we just talked about having a 4-inch or 4.5-inch exposure on the shingle. That very first starter row will end up with about a 2 or a 3-inch exposure, and that will allow all the shingles from there on up to be butted up to the old shingle and keeps the roof laying flatter. So if that is done, then the roof will usually last 18 to 20 years. If that's not done, we can end up with areas where the shingle has to be bent over the edge of the tab. And the new shingles are bent over the edge of the tab, and we can actually get a little premature wear. So we're looking at like 16 to 18 years on the second layer.
What about the percentage of savings about if you went with the second one?
Well, what you save is the labor for removal. If you're paying somebody to put on the roof, by the time you pay for the dumpster and the hours and the effort to pull all that down, you can save quite a bit. About half the cost of the roof is going to be the labor to remove all the old shingles.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We have an email here from somebody who writes and says he lived in the country all his life and he hasn't yet seen a rain gutter that worked well. So, and this is a question for your dad. He says, I'd like to build a new house without gutters. What type of planning do I need to consider?
A gutterless system can be done. What you really want to do is work with the width of your soffit areas, your eaves, and also the pitch of the roof. Interestingly enough, the soffits are designed not only to keep the water from draining right down the side of the house and landing on top of the windows, but also to make use of solar gain or block solar gain. In the summertime, when our sun is up relatively high, it hits the roof, and we want the eave to stick out or the soffit to stick out far enough that that sun doesn't shine directly on the windows and come in there and give us a solar gain inside the house. But in the wintertime, the sun is really low on the horizon, so it tends to shine underneath the soffits and will come into the windows and help give us a little bit of solar gain. So depending on the pitch of the roof and how wide the eaves are, that'll make a big difference as to not only the efficiency, but how far out the water has to be from the foundation before it drips to the ground. Once you've got it out, and I'm going to use a number of about 3 foot, because for most pitches, that's a pretty good soffit for proper sun efficiency. Well, if you can get the water 3 feet out from the wall, we can put in what we call a drained gravel system, basically a perforated drain system with a plastic liner underneath it that will collect that water and run it into tiles, and we run the tiles downhill. That works very successfully. Matter of fact, we have done that on the front of Father's house because he had enough older trees that his gutter blocked up more often than what he wanted to climb a ladder and get up and take care of. Mm-hmm. So we took the gutters off, ran this trench, did make sure that we sloped the soil from the house down towards the trench away from the house, lined the trench with plastic, dropped in a plastic drain tile, perforated drain tile, and then backfilled it with a large washed river gravel, a round rock, and that seems to work quite well. The water drips off the edge of the roof, runs down into the gravel, gets picked up by the tile, and we have the tile running out towards the front yard, which has got about a foot and a half or 2 foot drop. And voila, a gutterless house. We don't have to clean the gutters. What I'll call self-cleaning, because even once you get debris in the rock, the force of the water dripping from the eave down onto the rock will clean it. You can go down there and look, and you can see even with their leaves or vines or whatever, there's always a line going right through that gravel where the drip edge actually is.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, it can be
so
done.
So it is possible. I would think that it might be. Would it be more difficult, depending on what your site was like, if the place where you were siting your house was kind of on the flat side, then I'm thinking, well, okay, how do you make sure that all this water that you're collecting off the roof, you're really draining it well off away, and you don't end up with some kind of weird hydrologic thing where it's somehow or another that water is going to end up finding its way back into your basement if you have a basement.
Well, unfortunately for us around this area, there's no way to guarantee that to happen. Ideally, we do have the lot draining away from the house. There's actually a Boca building code that states that the distance from the bottom of the siding or wood framing of the house to the exterior soil should be 4 to 6 inches. And from that point to a point 10 feet out in the yard should have another 6 to 8 inches of drop. So if you stand 10 feet away from your house, where your feet are should be 14 inches lower than what the bottom of the siding is, which means the house is on a hill. Well, that doesn't happen in a lot of areas. Yeah. It would reduce a lot of the moisture problems if it did. So, yeah, you're first going to have to make sure that you have a site that will drain, a place to drain it to. And it's amazing how flat things can look and still have a slope. You get a transit and you shoot the elevations, and I think you'll find most yards do have a pretty good slope, even if they do look flat.
Yeah.
So getting that water out and away shouldn't be all that difficult. And particularly if you're in a farm area, if you look at most farmhouses, there's 4 to 5 steps up to the front porch. That's because our grandfathers knew to build the house up out of the ground so they could put some grading around it. Nowadays, they're like, oh, we don't want to have that many steps. We want to be able to make it either handicap accessible or 1 or 2 steps, and we're barely getting our wood framing up out of the ground. If you stop at the threshold of your front door, you have to realize that where that threshold is, we've got basically 3/4 inch of plywood, which is our subfloor. We then have our floor joist, which is generally a 2x10, and that floor joist sits on a sill plate, which is a 2x6 or 2x8 that's laid flat, so it's another 2 inches. So when you're standing at that threshold, your wood framing your house is actually about 12 inches below you. So you have to have 1 or 2 steps. Since we don't want to step more than 7 inches, we have to have a minimum of 2 steps just to get the wood framing above the dirt outside. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we get these farmhouses 5 steps to the front porch. The windows for the basement are sticking up out of the ground. We can add some soil around there and get a good slope away and do some landscaping and put some plastic under the landscaping. And it's amazing how far you can get that water to run before it ever soaks back down towards the foundation.
All right. Our guest this morning, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly program on home maintenance, and we're getting kind of close to the end here, although if somebody really wants to call quick, we might be able to get in one more question, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, is there anything in particular that, given the time of year, you might want to talk about?
Actually, I was going to go all the way back to the beginning of the program. We had the young lady call in about condensation in her garage. I happened this weekend to be down in Effingham, Illinois, helping a buddy play with some hot rods, which is my secondary hobby. And he had a dehumidifier running in there, and he was just so amazed that when I told him he should run a dehumidifier in this detached garage, it's not air-conditioned, it's not attached to the house, he was just amazed at how much cooler the house or the garage was and how he could work out there without having the air conditioner on, even in this weather. Now, granted, he has what I'll call the ultimate garage. It's like 40 by 60. with a big concrete floor. But by running the dehumidifier, it was comfortable in there. Even though it was almost 85 degrees out there, it was comfortable to work on cars. So we were having a good time, and he just couldn't believe how the big difference a power dehumidifier would make versus putting in even a window air conditioner.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, we certainly have talked about that, the fact that the air conditioning, essentially what it's one of the big things it's doing for you is it's taking moisture out of the air. It's making the air drier, which ends up making you feel more comfortable, in addition to the fact that, yeah, it's pumping cold air out of the duct.
Well, it looks like somebody may have actually tried to sneak in on
all
it.
Right,
see
we'll
get
that.
One quick one.
One, we'll go here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wondered real quick, if there are any issues with putting vinyl siding over wood? We have cedar wood that's painted, and the paint's in good condition at this point in time, but we're getting older and we're looking down the road where we'd maybe like to have something we don't have to fool with anymore, and I don't know if there are moisture issues when you put vinyl over wood or what. Thank you, and I'll just listen.
All right.
No, you should be fine with that. The vinyl siding is not a weather barrier or a water barrier. It's a weather barrier, not a water barrier. So you can, what they'll want to do is put probably either a wrap or a tar paper or something over the top of the wood. Sometimes they'll use a thin foam insulation board, basically to keep the vinyl siding laying flatter and looking better. But no, the vinyl siding over the top of wood siding should not create a problem. As long as the wood siding is sealed around all your windows and doors, the vinyl siding would just then protect the wood and give the house a nicer maintenance-free look. So I would have to say that that would be acceptable.
Okay. About a minute here. Any, again, last sort of thing you might want to mention this time around?
Well, don't believe that when the temperature drops to 70 degrees outside that you need to open every window in the house and pull that moisture back in.
Yes. It's the old, well, see, now, that's, I guess it's kind of a trade-off if you want to have some fresh air. But absolute point that, as you said, if you have air conditioning, one of the things that it's been doing is it's been removing moisture. And if you do open the windows, that's going to let it back in the house again. And so the next time you decide, okay, now it's hot and uncomfortable, we're going to close the windows again, then your air conditioning is just going to have to work that much harder to pump that moisture back out.
I can see
again.
These sessions are starting to sink
listen,
in. We might have the David Inge show here shortly.
No. I always defer to you guys, but there are a few things that I've learned from you and your dad over the years, and that's one of them, although sometimes it's kind of hard to fight the urge to have a little fresh air.
The high humidity in this area does mean that the fresh air is in limited supplies.
Okay. Well, there, we're going to have to leave it for this time around with the promise that next month Scott will be back and we'll be doing it again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the callers.
Scott Spies, he's home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service.